The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Well, unfair? As Tesco performs a reverse ferret on unpaid work experience, the government attacks its opponents as anti-business job snobs.
So I think we should encourage companies and encourage young people to expand work experience because it gives people the chance of seeing work and all that it involves and gives them a better chance to get a job.
Also this week, as the Treasury counts its pennies after bumper tax receipts in January, is George Osborne planning a giveaway in next month's budget? And will the Lib Dems get the particular income tax cut that they are now openly lobbying for? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Zoe Williams, The Guardian writer Shiv Malik, who's also the author of Jilted Generation, How Britain Has Bankrupted Its Youth, and from the right-of-centre think tank Policy Exchange, we've got Matthew Oakley. A warm welcome to you all. David Cameron has said that fairness means giving people what they deserve. Not a million miles away, you might have thought, from the old slogan, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. But this week, a Tesco store caused outrage when it advertised a permanent unpaid position on its night shift for applicants to the government's work experience scheme. The company called it a mistake and has now offered to pay anyone who turns up under the programme, but the episode has left a sour taste in the mouth. High-profile companies like Sainsbury's and Waterstones have pulled the plug on the scheme, and the Conservative Employment Minister, Chris Grayling, has spent the week fighting a rearguard action.
The accusations about this scheme are absurd, and those are particularly targeting the supermarkets who've been very helpful to us in supporting this scheme, are frankly job snobs about the nature of the work those supermarkets are doing.
So, Shiv, you follow the details of this. There are different schemes, aren't there? There's some that are more compulsory than others, and there's some affecting disabled people and some job seekers. Could you just talk us through them, first of all?
That's right. There's about five schemes in all. And at one end, if you want, of the sort of scale of voluntary to mandatory is work experience, which has some elements of compulsion, i.e. if you pull out after a week, it lasts 8 weeks, and if you pull out after a week, then you can be penalised by having your benefits stripped for about 2 weeks. Then there is mandatory work activity, which, as the title suggests, is indeed mandatory. And if you pull out of that, you get heavily sanctioned. And I think it's up to 13 weeks for a first offence, if you want. Then, if you're long-term unemployed, i.e. for longer than about 9 to 12 months, you're then put on the work programme. Some of these companies that run the work programme have elements, again, of work experience. One company, Ingeus, Deloitte, has a scheme for it in its second year for 6 months. So you have to do work experience for 6 months. And some of those companies say it is mandatory. Some others say, well, it's not mandatory. But then they refer you back to the job centre to be sanctioned. The fourth scheme is called Community Activity Programme. It's a new scheme announced. So once you've gone through the work programme, now you're heading on to your third year as unemployed. You are longer than that almost. Then you have to do 6 months of unpaid work. Now, the government has said that and there's also new policy proposals to make to include other people in this group, including those who are on ESA, Employment Support Allowance.
Which are disabled or sick people.
Long-term sick and disabled, that's right. So those are the nature of the schemes. And the government has said over the weekend, they've clarified, they said, look, mandatory work, if it's done, is always for community benefit. However, when you dig down into the papers and to try and find out what that means, because I sort of kept asking the DWP, well, what do you mean by community benefit? And it seems to be sort of a variable phrase. It doesn't just mean charities and public bodies. It also means private companies. And this is what's been the most interesting thing about it. So we know that 24,000 people now, in the last 6 months alone, have been sent on mandatory work activity from job centres. And it's private companies who administer that bit of it. So it's 4 weeks unpaid. And we're trying to figure out where those people are going. And we know in one case, one company said, yes, we send them to private companies. So it's all still in flux. It's all very interesting. And as you've said before, some companies have pulled out of the work experience scheme, which is the biggest flagship of all these schemes.
Well, so Matthew, there's lots of different schemes there, clearly. But the one thread that runs through it is that at some point there's an element of threat. You take the work and then you either have to take it or you have to stick with it once you've taken it, and otherwise you get your benefits snatched away. And does that make it unfair, do you think?
I don't think it's unfair at all. I mean, I think across both sides of the House of Commons, you see arguments about benefits being something for something. And so you should be giving something back if you're on benefits, whether that's, you know, in terms of community work, or whether that's actually just making sure that you're doing all you can to find work. That's the kind of deal that we think, and the government, I know, thinks benefit claimants should be putting up. I think the important thing is to realise that, you know, as Shiv was saying, that these different schemes are actually quite different. So they're actually intended to do different things as well. So on the side of the mandatory work activity, that's actually targeted at groups who are assessed to be actually perhaps shying away from their responsibilities in terms of job seeking. So it's trying to find those people who might be working on the side, taking cash in hand, while also claiming benefits. And obviously that's not fair. So actually, you know, making them do these kind of schemes is actually quite effective way of, you know, sorting out that kind of group and making them move off benefit more quickly. Then the other two schemes are actually trying to help people, you know. So the work experience scheme, I know it's got a lot of flack in the press over the last few days, but you know, these are young people with little work experience. It's targeted at those young people who are furthest away from the labour market, and giving them the opportunity to get experience in work, whether that be 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks. You know, that's a good thing. It looks good on their CV. It shows that they've done something, and you know, these firms are taking them on and actually providing them with you know, skills which we all take for granted now. But certainly, I know when I started work, I wasn't particularly good at, you know, turning up at the right time and, you know, making sure I was dressed properly and whatever. And that's the kind of thing which is being taught to these, you know, the young people going on these schemes. I think that's really effective.
Isn't there a point here though that you could always say all of us are learning at work all of the time? And, you know, why should The Guardian pay me? Why should Policy Exchange pay you? We're enhancing our career prospects by having a career at the moment.
Sure. I mean, I think the point is that it's making these firms actually look at people and take risks on people they wouldn't normally take. So, you know, at the moment, we've got quite a loose labour market. There's high unemployment. And frankly, long-term unemployed young people do get pushed towards the back of the queue. Now, you've seen research recently from the CIPD, which shows that firms are not likely to take on young people who are unemployed. I mean, that's just a fact. And so actually giving the opportunity to these people to get that kind of experience is really important.
Zoe, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, my immediate thought is that obviously if these firms are using a lot of unpaid labour, that's not increasing the number of jobs in the firm, that's decreasing the number of jobs, and they're taking work that somebody could be paid for. Now, sure, it's experience, but as you say, all jobs are experience. You're always learning on the job. I don't really think it's very important not to be cowed by this charge of job snobbery. It's not snobbery to say some jobs are skilled and some jobs aren't. It's not snobbery to say that a young person packing shelves is doing that company a service. They don't unpack the shelves, as Shiv said earlier, when the young person leaves. It is not snobbery to say, you know, you deserve to be paid for doing this work. And I think it's a very dangerous game to get into, to say because you're in a certain segment of society which is unlikely to find employment, not, by the way, because you're a deficient person, but because unemployment is very high, then your time is suddenly worth nothing. And it's not at all the same as going to school, because, you know, your schooling experience is there to boost your skills, you know.
I suppose it depends on whether or not we choose to take the £65 a week or whatever it is of job seekers allowance as in some way equivalent to a wage, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah, that's the point. Well, one of the points is that obviously these people aren't doing this for free. You know, they are being paid benefits, whether that's job seekers allowance, that's housing benefit, you know, some people on tax credits potentially. Now, there's quite a lot of money that gets built up.
But then you have to answer the fact that the government is subsidising super profits by the supermarkets. And this is a huge problem. You know, this employment block is 900,000 people. It's the largest employment block outside the NHS. If we're going to subsidise them and that money's going to go straight to the shareholders, I think all people, taxpayers as well as the unemployed, are going to say, well, hang on a second, why should I?
I mean, I think the point there is this isn't a new thing, yeah? So under New Labour, under the Brown days, we had no fifth option.
Well, I don't think that's a great point.
Which
become a good thing just because it's
thing. But it's not a new thing. And so this kind of like outrage now, it just seems a little bit kind of strange, because it's been going on before. It's been shown to be effective for some groups.
I just think that's a false argument, because you can't say because this has happened before, it was the right thing to do. People have been arguing against this for years. Mayor in Somerset Webb was arguing against this in 2007. Unions have been arguing against it for a long, long time. The fact that the Labour government might have instituted it or might have continued it is neither here nor there. We've got to look at where we are and say, is this fair? And do we want to spend our tax money on it?
I think it is fair. It's given these young people the skills and experience they wouldn't otherwise have.
One question raises actually, does it work? Does work experience as a scheme actually make people more employable? And the stats at the moment suggest that that's not actually true at all. In fact, it makes you less employable. So the measure should be what Ian Duncan Smith says and repeated by Nick Clegg and Cameron yesterday at Prime Minister's Question Times, was that people, half of the people who do this go sign off. Actually, they said get a job, but it's actually get a job or sign off from JSA. And the real comparison is when you compare those people against people who haven't done work experience and see, well, how fast do they sign off or get a job? And the answer is actually people who are not doing work experience tend to sign off or get a job faster. And the mechanism is, and that's according to the government's own statistics to start with, it's actually about 60% rather than 50%. And the mechanism for that is simply that people have more time to look for work because they're not stacking shelves in Tesco's. So that's one point. And the other point to make is when the government instituted these schemes back in 2011, this is the mandatory work activity scheme, they thought they'd have about 10,000 people a year. As you rightly say, the idea was to get the hardest to reach people sort of back into some form of work. The figures at the moment now range to about 24,000 in 6 months. And it's actually overtaken the amount of people month by month doing work experience, the largest, supposedly larger scheme. So it's not quite right to say, I mean, the question is then how many hard or difficult cases do we have? It seems it's a mushrooming number month by month.
So do you find yourself feeling sorry though for people who, because the way, if you do think of it as a wage, £65 a week, it's such a low wage, you know, it's less than £2 an hour, isn't it, if someone's doing 30 or 40 hours of work experience? Isn't that a problem? If the benefits are at a slightly more decent level, then don't you think your argument might have a bit more bite?
I mean, I think it's important to remember that you're just talking about job seekers allowance, and of course with job seekers allowance comes a lot of other things. So you've got, as I said, you've got housing benefits, potentially tax credits. If you've got children, you've got child benefit. If you've got council tax benefit, all of these things add up to quite a large
amount.
That's
not cash in hand.
No, it's not.
That goes to the council, or it goes to
Bangalore. It's money that we all spend.
But
it's money that low income, working families spend money on.
Can I raise the point as well that supermarkets were already paying so far below a living wage that many people working for supermarkets were in receipt of those ancillary benefits anyway? So we've been subsidising the supermarkets in paying their low wages for a very, very long time. And the fact that they're now getting free labour is, I think, the final straw.
But this is a fascinating argument which you're proposing. You're saying, in fact, actually, people should basically stop working if you're okay and just pull out, and that's fine because they can go on benefits and do it from there. But presumably that's not what the right or the left particularly wanted. Work should pay, and because hard work is a good thing. And if both parties say that, in a sense, or both spectrums say that, then there's nothing quite like a wage to incentivize people to actually get them into work. But if we mandate them to do unpaid work all this time, people actually, I mean, the stories that I'm hearing as people write into me saying, it's just the most horrific thing when you get a mandatory work activity form. It tells you you must do, it's like a conscription form because you can't really pull out of it because you lose your benefits for 13 weeks or 26 weeks. That's 6 months to you and I, if you don't do it a second time. And they said, well, look, I'm now being forced to do this work and I feel like this is the worst thing ever. And it demoralises people, is what people have been saying to me.
Can I just, I mean, there does seem to me that there was a problem with the old job seeker allowance rule whereby you volunteered and then you lost your benefits. You weren't allowed to be volunteering, which meant, you know, if you're from a rich family, you'd probably be subsidised to come do a work placement at, dare I say, the Guardian, and if you're not, then you wouldn't be able to. So there was maybe a case for changing that, but now we're hearing stories, she was saying earlier, of people who are doing voluntary work of the type that would actually further their own interests, you know, in the sector that they want to work in. But because there's so much mandatory stuff, they're suddenly being shunted into Poundland or wherever else it is. Instead, isn't that a danger? It gets so heavy-handed that people can't follow their own interests and therefore can't build the sort of career that they might want to.
I mean, I think there's clearly a balance to be struck there between trying to target the schemes on people who are either trying to avoid getting back into work or are actually could be helped by the schemes. I think that in certain cases that probably hasn't been done effectively. I know one thing we're immensely keen on is the fact that all of these schemes, whether it be workfare, conditionality, whether it be the support you get from JobsCentre Plus or through the work programme, it should be targeted a lot better. It shouldn't be much more about personalisation, looking at the barriers that people are facing to try and get back to work, and really tackling those issues, not just saying, you know, you're 18 or 22 and you've been on benefits for 6 months, and, you know, those sorts of things. It should be, you know, looking at the qualifications, looking at skills, looking at, you know, whether these people have drug problems, whether they have, you know, problem backgrounds with their family, and trying to tackle some of those issues rather than just bunching people into broad categories. And then, you know, I think that leads to situations where you do have inappropriate measures targeted at the wrong people.
Although I guess it's often difficult to address, say, mental health problems in a context where someone's frightened they might lose their money.
Oh, sure, but you can't set up a system which is so lax that you don't expect anything of people. I mean, I think the one thing we haven't talked about here is actually, you know, we've heard a lot from Shiv about what the people going on the schemes think, but we haven't actually heard about what the public think. And actually, there's huge support for these kind of schemes. So the surveying we've done about a year ago now through YouGov showed that 80% of people agreed with community work for people who've been unemployed for 12 months. That's 80% of people believing in workfare. That seems a
fair point, isn't it? So we've asked Matthew here lots of very difficult questions. We haven't asked you any yet. And there's a poll out, I think, this morning saying that, yes, something like 3/4 of people do indeed want benefits to be cut.
I think that was, yeah, I mean, those are two separate questions, right? One of them is, do you agree with this working principle? And I would counter that they probably didn't realise it meant something as basic as working in a supermarket.
The
people responding to the poll. If you say, right, should people have to work, they probably thought you meant something that would be beneficial to them and to the community. And this whole kind of repackaging of big businesses as a favour to the community, I find one of the most ridiculous things about the whole argument. I had an argument about B&Q the other day when somebody said they're giving jobs to local people. It's like, of course they are. Where else are they going to get them? It's ridiculous.
But anyway, there is a point, isn't there, about people don't like welfare at the moment.
Look, I think, I mean, I know that this is going to sound very Guardian, but there is a huge problem with the way the debate is framed. Even the fact that you kind of talk about welfare is very different to talking about social security. There was a time not too long ago when you used to talk about social security as the safety net for when things befell you that might befall us all. So when you were young, when you were old, when you were ill, when you were unemployed, these things might happen to any of us. That has been completely subverted into a conversation about welfare, welfare fraud, welfare in a kind of American context, which is interchangeable with the word lowlife. I mean, you know, I obviously, when people are asked in that context whether the welfare bill should be cut, they say, yeah, because they're kind of picturing this huge morass of completely workless sloths. But I think if you went back and said, in an area of very high unemployment, should people be penalised for being unemployed? I think people would say no. So really, the problem is that the opposition isn't launching a stout enough defence of welfare.
So, Shiv, one thing that could change the debate at the moment is there's a row going on. We've got to be careful here because there's an investigation about one of the providers that's getting people into work, A4E. And is it fair to say that whatever else is going on there and wherever the allegations lead, it looks like some people have got very rich on the back of some very poor people?
Well, the Daily Mail splashed not so long ago, and this maybe makes an interesting argument about public opinion, with Emma Harrison's sort of paycheck, if you want. She managed to pay herself from her own company. She owns A4E, 8.6 million or thereabouts out of the profits from the year. And what they were upset about is that she'd effectively, the A4E is itself basically all run on public government contracts. So this was public money going to her privately. She is also, incidentally, appointed by Cameron as the family czar, meant to get sort of people who don't work hard enough back into work as such. So it comes at an awkward moment in that sense for him, that there is this investigation. There are questions about whether she will stay in her post as family czar. However, perhaps to respond, there doesn't seem to be much problem, I don't think, with there was a lot of outrage at Tesco taking people on, but there is a good section of society that goes, well, hang on, yes, there is a scarring effect, and we know this from research, that if people are out of employment for a very long time, they do you know, suffer in later life continuously in terms of their employment prospects and salary, etc. And yes, it is a good thing to get people into habits of work, into doing work, and why not? The question is who for and under what conditions, really? And that's really, I think, where the debate's been focused and turned, really.
Okay, well, let's leave the question of workfare just for a moment and quickly spool forward to next month's budget. George Osborne had some rare good news in January, with tax receipts coming in more strongly than thought. And some of the pundits, who knows what's going on inside the Treasury, Matthew, but some of the pundits are saying he might have a £10 billion war chest to play with. Now, in terms of both who deserves a bit of a break at the moment in these tough times, and in terms of what might do something about getting people into jobs, what would you like to see him do next month?
I mean, the one thing I think, I start with what I don't want to see him do, and that is kind of focus on short-term politics. I think the debate...
And what would that be? What would be a gimmicky short-term thing?
The sorts of things which you've seen in the last couple of fiscal events, where it's literally a policy to get the front page of the news, and that sort of thing, giving away relatively small amounts of money to relatively small groups of people, but it's kind of a soundbite, kind of making policy by soundbite rather than actually looking at what's going wrong with the economy. And I think where we're really focusing is looking at actually where we are and what the problems are with the UK economy and what the kind of structural problems are, and trying to tackle those issues so we can actually get in a better place in 5-10 years and actually be much stronger. And those sorts of things, you know, obviously everyone likes to see tax reduced, but not in a short-term way, but actually doing that so it's a long-term policy.
But what tax? I mean, it'd be hard to imagine George Osborne suddenly deciding to ramp up state spending after everything he said. I mean, if he got a bit of money to spend, the Lib Dems are now lobbying in an extraordinary public way. It should be an increase in the personal allowance. Some people are saying it should be a reduction in the 50p rate. Ed Balls is saying it should be less VAT, and some people are saying, no, you need to look at the business side if you really want to create jobs. Where would, if you'd got this £10 billion to play with, which I know is a bit of a dream world, but
indeed,
would you shove it?
I'll try and avoid the temptation to say to reduce the deficit, but
you can say that if you want.
No,
maybe you shouldn't give away at all.
I mean, I guess that would be the ideal situation, but you know, politically, where we are is that, you know, that's just not going to happen. I think where we'd like to see a bit of extra spending is trying to ease up finance to small and medium-sized firms. So, you know, there's some relatively straightforward things you can do. The HMRC used to have does have a scheme which gives companies time to pay their tax if they're struggling to make cash flow with cash flow issues. And 2008-09, that was really ramped up and gave help to a lot of firms. And that has now shrunk back quite heavily because of what HMRC are doing. We'd like to see that extended again.
Okay, and Shiv, I mean, you've obviously written a lot about the younger generation being bankrupted. What could you do to make them solvent again?
Interestingly, there are whispers, certainly, because most of the people staffing Conservative sort of offices, if you want, are young, and they've noticed that they can't really live anywhere because rents are so extortionately high, and they certainly won't be buying as was promised to a previous generation. And those figures keep coming out and keep getting worse and worse in terms of our overall house ownership. So I would start building houses. Why not? Great way to boost the economy, jobs. You get something you actually need.
Everyone seems to be nodding here.
I feel like Peppa Pig, but that's exactly what I was going to say.
And you know what? 10 billion... will go a long way in terms of house building.
But the big problem there is that we can't build houses because of the planning system, yeah?
Well, indeed. So we need changes underfoot, and you'd have a resistance, if you want, from an older generation, and this is where it gets interesting, who don't want, you know, houses in the area. But you can correct that, because actually most people do want houses in the area if they're nicer than their own, i.e. if they're going to improve their own property value. They don't want social housing in that sense, it's true. But our standards of housing are so low, we don't have any standards. We're the only Western developed country without obvious housing standards and room sizes, that kind of thing, which is remarkable.
It's like you're reading from one of our reports, actually.
It's true, I am.
The funny thing is,
I have read it.
It ticks so many boxes, doesn't it? Because not only does it stimulate the economy, but it, you know, the rental market urgently needs to be addressed to hold the thieving of the younger generation. There's nothing that house building wouldn't tick.
Okay, let's cut through this outbreak of consensus, because I'm sure it makes for very boring listening. Zoe, yes. One place there isn't consensus is inside the government, where the Liberal Democrats, and we used to have this thing called budget purdah, where no one was allowed to say anything or they'd be shot, you know, for weeks before the budget about what might happen to tax rates. But now the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, no less, and the Deputy Prime Minister are letting it be known that they are lobbying intensely in private to get the personal allowance up, a sort of general income tax cut for everyone. Do you think they're going to win this argument, and do you think they should?
I am interested in the personal allowance. I would personally, but I'm kind of with Ed Balls, really. If you're going to make a tax cut, I think you need to cut VAT first, because I think 20% is swinging. But, you know, the personal tax allowance is a decent place to start if you're not going to start there. The whole thing about, it is quite interesting, because there's just, what it really shows is that there's no roadmap for coalition, and they are obviously thinking, well, you know, the rules as they used to stand no longer apply. Every time Nick Clegg finally manages to drag everybody into line on his side, David Cameron's side suddenly erupts, and you can kind of see that everything's unravelling a little bit. All the kind of ways that things used to be done are unravelling, and I think that's quite interesting. And I wonder if we won't kind of usher in a more German system where negotiations between coalition parties are done much more openly to start off with.
What do you think? Do you think that would be a good thing to have the arguments in public a bit more, rather than everyone having to say yes, we agree, and then brief the newspapers something quite different?
Yeah,
it's all quite fun, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just pretty interesting to hear what people are thinking and saying. You know, it's just going back to the policy, I don't know. I'm not sure we'd personally agree with, you know, pushing the allowance up any more quickly. It's a lot of money, and, you know, I think, as I was saying earlier, that the really key thing is to make sure you're focusing on things which are long term, which is why, you know, we completely disagree with the VAT cut, for instance, because if you're doing it short term, it doesn't make any impact. You can only do it long term. If you want to do it long term, fine, but if you're just doing it for a year, then
I would think you'd bring it down to 17.5% for the foreseeable future, just as it's been since forever until the financial crash. I mean, this kind of jerking up and down is a really new thing.
It's not good for anybody. So,
well, it's not forever, incidentally, until about sort of the 1980s, it was pretty low.
Right, so, not forever, okay.
That's when that systemic change happened.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to leave that there for this week, and of course, we'll be back next week, but also you can follow the rumblings towards the budget at guardian.co.uk/politics. My thanks to Zoe Williams, to Shiv Malik, and to Matthew Oakley. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.